All right. Hello, everyone. This is David Chaim. We're very fortunate to have Rabbi Fuhrman on our call today, speaking to us around the topic of when is denial of pleasurable impulses and needs proper, and when is it destructive? Without further ado, Rabbi Fuhrman.
Okay. So thank you all for taking the time to give me a chance to talk and feel good about myself. So I'm not sure if that impulse is is an impulse I should deny or not. And I think that that's really as good as any place to start, because I think that we have to be realistic about human nature, and that we are motivated by things that make us feel good. Now, you know, the difference between an animal and a human being is that we have the wonderful capacity of our intellect to allow us to make connections and allow us to define things and frame things in a way that attaches meaning to things that wouldn't necessarily be meaningful to an animal. So when you
Rabbi Fuhrman perhaps fell off the line, I'm afraid, Chevra. So let's please stay muted, and we'll hope that he's able to resume his connection. Okay. For those of you that are joining us, Rabbi Fuhrman is speaking about when is denial of pleasurable impulses and needs proper, and when is it destructive. I thought it was a very eye-opening that he began by thanking us for being on the line so he can feel good about himself, which was a very interesting opening. And I apologize to the Chevra for any further delays and issues with phone services. To say for him, so we're waiting for Rabbi Fuhrman to return to the line. Very interesting opening. You know, it really is interesting for those of us that are involved in any kind of public arena or forum. And, you know, we see speakers, and sometimes I certainly am probably guilty of that, but love to speak just to hear their own voice. And so who are we pleasing? Are we pleasing our audience, or are we pleasing ourselves? So that was the opening of Rabbi Feuerman's speech. Hold on, Kevra. Again, my apologies for the interruption here. Let's see. And while we wait for Rebecca.
Okay, sorry, folks. I don't know what happened there, but I got disconnected. But now you can hear me, right?
Yes, we do hear you. And
my apologies.
Okay,
I was saying about the, you know, the idea that you know, we're so motivated by basically what makes us feel good, and we're motivated also by fear. So we could define the idea of doing kindness, being part of a community, feeling connected to a community, establishing our mortality, our immortality, you know, by engaging in Torah mitzvahs, all these symbolic structures that we make for ourselves from a psychological point, they're not untrue, but they do require us to define things. And so when someone says, I want to speak, or I'm going to consider the request to speak and do a group, you know, as much as humility and all that's important, if your humility extends to the point where you value the endeavor, then you're going to end up not really doing it or not being motivated to do a really good job of it. Right, there's a Gemara in Bava Kamma on Daf Samach Vavam, I think it's on Samach Vavam at Aleph, if I remember right. It's around there, where there's a discussion of, you know, the damages that one has to pay if you cause somebody else harm. The Gemara over there, as some of you may be familiar, that according to Jewish law, there's five axes that damage is determined. There's Nezek, Tsar, Ribui, Shevis, Boshes, which means that there's different dimensions of harm. You know, there can be embarrassment, there could be medical costs, there could be a permanent disablement, there's loss of livelihood temporarily. All those things in the Talmudic calculus gets added up. So one of them is that you have to pay the physician's bills for a person who experiences you get in a fight with somebody and you hurt them, you punch them in the face, you have to pay the doctor's bills. So the Gemara says, what if you have a friend of yours who's willing to treat, your friend is a doctor, and he's willing to treat the victim for free, right? Can you do that? Because on the one hand, you know, the court establishes that you owe the money and you owe the doctor's bills to the victim, but on the other hand, you can supply it without it costing you any money because you have a good friend of yours who's a doctor who's willing to treat the person. And the Gemara says, "Asya de mugain, mugain shavia," which means in English, basically, a doctor that works for free is worth his fee. In other words, leaving the rhyme aside, it's saying that if the doctor is doing the patient, quote, a favor, he's not going to do a good enough job. So the compensation that you have to give this victim, that he gets a proper cure, you can't have a doctor supply that for free because there'll be something in the quality of the work. Now, this is coming from the same esteemed, strongly value-driven individuals, right? The sages of the Talmud, who would obviously advocate kindness, selflessness, humility, right? All those, you know, all those great qualities, but right, they're not willing to trade in the realities of human nature. In other words, the rabbis advocate the idea of doing kindness, and by all means, you know, if you're a doctor and someone can't afford your treatment and you want to treat the person for no charge or for reduced charge, that's kindness. But the rabbis were also realistic about human nature and that they couldn't see the doctor in a typical situation being able to supply the same degree of care than if he was being paid. And that's why the person who does the damage, the person who is responsible for the damage, you know, must supply a paid physician, right? So what does that tell you? That tells you that we can have all the highfalutin motivations that we want, and those are certainly worthy, but we also have to be realistic. We have to be realistic about what motivates our behavior and what makes us do a good job. And that's as good as a segue into this discussion, which is that we have very lofty ideas about what we should do and who we should be and how we should feel and how we should behave. And by all means, we shouldn't in any sense give up on those aspirations. But somehow we have to walk a tightrope between that and being realistic and not overshooting our aspirations to the point that we naively discount what are going to be our realistic needs for self-care, for physical nutrition, for emotional nutrition. We can't afford to act as if those things are slogans and they don't really mean anything. Right? So they mean a lot. And each person has to figure out, perhaps not alone, it's certainly a good idea to talk things over with somebody who you trust. You could discuss these things with a sponsor or anybody. But it is something to be weighed and measured, because each person can sustain a certain amount of self-deprivation, a certain amount of asceticism, and manage a certain amount, but every person hits their limit, and then if they overdo it, right, they burn out, or they become resentful, or if they don't watch it carefully, they act out. So these are very problematic and important areas, you know, for us to balance as human beings. And you're always going to find in Jewish literature and sources, you're always going to find dialectical statements, right? So you find many statements in the Midrashim or in the Gemara about Kaddish Atzlachov Amotzilach, but you have to really make yourself holy. The Ramban, the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim, talks about this, right? Really make yourself holy. You have to voluntarily abstain from pleasures. There's no question that abstention, voluntary abstention, is considered a very important pathway towards self-development and piety according to the Torah. And yet, you have contradictory statements, like in the beginning of it's in Nazir and it's in Nadarim, where it says, you know, by the Nazir, there's a verse that refers to the Nazir who became Tamei accidentally, and he becomes Tamei, he has to restart his Nazirus, and he has to, in order to restart the Nazirus, he has to bring Korbanos, but the Pasuk says, V'chiter olov asher chota al hanefesh, and he will get a kapara, he will get a forgiveness for that that he sinned over the soul. Now the Pasuk shot is, hanefesh means also like a person. So over here, the person would be the expired person, meaning the Nazir needs a kapara because he exposed himself to a tummy, dead body, a corpse. But the drash is that he has to bring a kapara on his own soul because he denies his soul pleasure. Right? He's in this world, and that the world offers all kinds of opportunities and pleasures. And the Nazir, right, the Nazir voluntarily abstains. Now the Gemara in Nazir on Days of Days and in the Dharma on Test of an Alus has a whole story about this, and the point is that if the Nazir really does it for the right reasons, if he can really see that he needs some way to cut back and to voluntarily abstain and to make a vow of abstention because he feels that he's getting too proud and his Yetzirah is taking over, so it's a very valuable thing. But if he overestimates and ends up depriving himself inappropriately, that's considered a chet. That is considered a sin to deprive oneself. So you got these dichotomies. You have these dialectics between what you're supposed to deprive yourself, you're supposed to experience pleasure. Like, you know, how's that supposed to work? And I think that one of the big challenges in any kind of recovery process is that you're trying to live a new kind of lifestyle, and that lifestyle is going to need to involve balance, because I think that one of the major challenges in the life of an addict is the ability to have balance. Oftentimes, you'll notice that addicts can function on the extremes, and the addiction kind of serves as the compensation and the balance for the extreme, for the other extreme. So somebody who's in an extremely unpleasant relationship and have a lot of difficulties might then act out with their addiction consciously or unconsciously, using it as a compensation, you know, to balance out the stress or the difficulties. A person who's a workaholic, you know, might work 14, 15 hours a day because there's a lot of pressure, and then maybe eats a lot. You know, there's always this balancing thing, but it's the wrong kind of balance. It's not balancing the character traits in a healthy way that allows for healthy living. It's trying to balance things in a way that work well enough that the addictive kind of behaviors are perpetuated, but they don't work well enough that they actually allow a person to function healthily. So balance is very important for addicts. It's really important for, you know, for everybody, because it's just life's work that we have. We're there's really, essentially, there's no such thing as a bad mida, because, number one, it's just true, but we'll get to that. But aside from that, it's philosophically untenable, because why would God create an imperfect being, right? Why would God create man if the sum total of all of his different urges and wishes and natural inclinations are bad? And obviously, logically, there's no such thing as a bad mida. There is a bad application of a mida. That's a very important point, right? So whether it's anger, or it's lust, or it's revenge, or it's even arrogance, the issue is the impulse and the drive is not necessarily bad, but the application of it and the proper mix of it in the equation oftentimes is very problematic. And so the goal of life is to have the correct balance, and balance doesn't necessarily mean 50%. Balance doesn't mean equal, because different things require different weights. So, for example, the Rambam in Hilchos Deos, I believe it's Perek Aleph, you know, talks about how you have to balance all your midos, and then he says that when it comes to anger, and when it comes to gaiver, when it comes to arrogance, you have to go all the way to the extreme. But even when he says going all the way to the extreme, in Perek Beis in Hilchos Deos, he talks about that you have to be, that there are times where you're supposed to be angry and there are times where you're supposed to be proud. So what he really means is, he means that you, and some of the notes of Kalim actually say this explicitly, I think the Maggid Mishnah says it, but I'm not sure, it's been a while since I've seen it, but the point is that for that mida, you have to find the balance. You know, it's like a little salt is good, right? If without salt, we're going to die. A lot of salt is bad because it could poison us, right? So you don't have, if you want to have a balanced diet, you don't have an equal amount of salt in your diet as you have protein. That would be very bad. But you're supposed to have a balanced diet. So balance doesn't mean that every element is equal. It means that you have the appropriate and healthy amount of that element. So you have an appropriate amount of salt in your diet, which is a very different amount of protein than you would have, or of carbs that you would have. So in the emotional diet, different midos have to be utilized in different proportions, but it's not that they're eliminated. There's a lot more to say on this topic, obviously, but I do want to give people a chance to respond. So I'll just end with one more thought related to this. So the Gemara in Sota on Mem Zayin and Aleph has a very interesting slogan, as it were. It says that Yetzer Isha V'Tinok Smol Docha V'Yamin Mekarevis, which translates into English as one's desire, one's lust, a wife, and a child, one should push away with the left hand and draw near with the right hand. Obviously, it's a pretty cryptic statement, and it's open to different kinds of interpretation, and we don't have time for all the interpretations, but I'll share with you differently than Rashi over there, and it's not time now to talk about the Rashi, differently than Rashi over there. The Ravid, in his Sefer Bali and Nefesh, which is basically the Ravid's treatise on how to conduct oneself with sanctity in marriage, and the Ravid, his interpretation of that statement in the Gemara is that any particular person at a particular time appropriately should satisfy their lust, you know, in permitted ways. Now, the Ravid is very clear that the Ravid actually lists five different motivations for a human being to engage in a sexual activity. And, you know, he starts with the highest motivation, then he goes to each motivation. And the Ravid is clear that this motivation would be the lowest motivation, but not the lowest motivation as in the lowest forbidden motivation, right? There probably could be, like, you know, an infinite number of forbidden motivations. So it's not like, you know, a failing grade. It's that he says that for some people at certain times, it will be constructive for them to indulge their lust in order to prevent them from sinning further, right? And so I shouldn't say sinning further because it wasn't a sin. In order to prevent them from sinning, period, to indulge their lust in a finished way. Again, all this is open to a lot of interpretation. However, the point is that everything still is about balance and that it takes a lot of wisdom and life experience and trust to a degree, right? Trust in one's essential goodness to allow oneself to accurately assess the motivation. You know, is one rationalizing this indulgence because they just want to indulge, or is this a necessary kind of self-care that's needed? And, you know, it's very complicated. And here's the interesting thing. Even when you experience a forbidden desire, the desire itself is forbidden, right? Some desires one is forbidden to actually engage in. You know, most things in the Torah, when it comes to most matters in the Torah, one is not responsible for their thoughts or their feelings. However, there are some things that we are responsible for, our thoughts or our feelings. Heretical thoughts could be problematic. Again, it's beyond the scope of this discussion to get into the details of that, but it could be problematic, just a heretical thought. And also, sexual thought beyond the initial impulse, because you can't control just thoughts that pop into your head. But what do you do afterwards if you dwell on the thought or you don't? Halakhically would be forbidden. The thing is, where it's interesting is that the desire itself, right, it's expressing itself in a forbidden way, but the desire itself is just a human process. And again, like I said, there's nothing bad about the human, right? The desire is expressing itself in a way that's forbidden. But there's nothing bad about the human. And so sometimes, you know, what Chazal might be saying over here, when you're dealing with the Yetzer, sometimes a frontal assault, like trying to smash the Yetzer down, even though, yes, there's definitely a thing called Milchemes HaYetzer, a war with the Yetzer. But sometimes if you want to smash something and you fight it directly, you actually, empower it in different ways. And you also, sometimes it's also very hard to win a war with yourself because, by very definition, you can't win a war with yourself because you're matched against an equal partner. And while it's an interesting mental trick to call the Yetzer Hara something different than you, that you're fighting, you know, the devil as it were, you're fighting the Yetzer Hara, but actually it is you that you're fighting. And so it's kind of hard to win a fight against yourself. And sometimes it might be more valuable to, you know, to frame and understand better what the struggle represents. And if you think about it, when one experiences a certain kind of lust, it doesn't have to be materialized in that way. It doesn't have to be materialized sexually. You know, I think many of us could relate to the following picture I'm about to paint. It's the late spring. It's really heading towards summer. There's freshness in the air. You can smell the grass. You can smell the flowers. It's actually brought down. It's brought down the Chazal in two places, by Hebe Meikzir Hachitim in Megillas Rus, and also by the Maaseh with Amnon and Tamar. That, you know, at that time where the harvest comes in, a person is feeling very aroused because it's the time of year where flowers are blooming. We're coming out of the winter. We're not holed up anymore. We're not frozen. Certainly in contemporary times, people are dressing a lot more loosely, right? And so you're walking in the street, and many impulses might hit you. And some of those impulses, if you were to dwell on those thoughts, they'd be halakhically forbidden. But what's really going on? You know, what's really going on? Because you're walking in springtime, the flowers on the air, right? You're full of life. You're full of life. You're feeling powerful. You're feeling happy. You're feeling excited. And if you're full of life and you're feeling powerful and you're feeling excited, you want to connect. You want to connect. You want to love somebody. You want to perhaps even procreate and bring more children into the world. That impulse itself is really not a crazy idea at all. You're at the moment basically surrounded by beauty, and you're seeing beauty, and you want to be a part of it. And to just take that desire and smash it down and say, this is war against the Yetzer Hara, and try to kill it, it's squashing a flower. The thought might be more, I'm becoming aroused, which is making me lust, and becoming aroused, and I'm so caught up in the beauty and the power of life and existence, right? What can I do, you know, to honor that feeling that's stirring within myself without disrespecting my morality, my code of conduct, right? Even if a person is married, their wife might not be available, and there are people that are not married. So how does one celebrate life and hope and growth and optimism and all this power that's hitting you in the face on a beautiful early, you know, summer day? Like, that's what I'm trying to say over here, that you don't have to necessarily kill off yourself, because you can't kill yourself without killing yourself, in order to deal constructively with desire. Okay, I spoke too much. Time for other people to comment.
Thank you, Rabbi Feuerman. Thank you.
Rabbi Feuerman, thank you very much. Appreciate your great insights. Very, very novel. It's not something we often get to discuss on this call at the level that you're speaking of, so I appreciate that. So I'd like to open it up to some questions. I know we're running short on time. I'm going to leave the recording on. You don't have to give your name. Some of the best remarks are given after the questions. If you feel like, I'll do this for about 5 minutes, and then I'll turn off the recording in case somebody would like to ask other questions. Rabbi Feuerman, do you have time to stay on for about another 10 minutes?
Unfortunately, even though I'm the one who came late because of a medical urgent matter, I don't, because I set up another conference call at 1, but what I could say is like this, you know, certainly if some people do, you know, have questions, they want to email me, you can find my email on the GYE site, but it's my name, Simcha Feuerman.
Or actually, why don't you just, let's just suggest that they email me and I'll forward them to you.
Great.
That would
okay,
be
that could become part
good.
Of the dialogue. Sure.
Time for one question, maybe? One question?
Go ahead, Velva, one question.
One question, quick. Okay, Rabbi Feuerman, thank you for your lucidity. It was very clear, and it was very interesting. One question I have is, and I'm sure you must have encountered people that have multiple addictions. So, like, is there any way, because you're talking about pleasure and the need for pleasure, and we always talk about sublimation in the group, you know, to switch from one thing. Do you have a course? Do you have a way to discuss this in a snapshot? And then I'll get to you later, maybe, of somebody who's struggling with multiple addictions. And I am having success in one, in the lust, but some things like food and other things are just out of whack. So I wonder if you have a small comment on that.
Well, your question is, if you have multiple addictions, I think I understand your question, if you have multiple addictions, so many avenues that other people could, in a healthy, balanced way, engage in, a person who has these multiple addictions, those avenues are cut off because for them it would be a trigger. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm talking about, let's say, something like food or something like some other stuff. So, you know, like, you know, the addict, I'm talking about me also, okay, I look for escapes. So if I can't escape into the world because I have some sobriety time, thank God, I'm doing well, thank God. So now I look to you know, so the other things now I might be taking advantage of. How do you deal with the multitude of the different things coming from different directions, different... I was told that some people don't go to, 12-step rooms of a different addiction until they get one, like really doing well in one. So I'm just wondering what you thought about that.
Oh, so your question is different. You're saying, is it possible to take on more than one addiction at the same time? Is it advisable, or do you do them one at a time? Is that your question?
That's part of it, but also just, you're talking about pleasure. Yeah, but that's part of it. That's part of it.
Well, I don't have a strong opinion about that. I don't know. I would imagine each person might have to sort that out for themselves. I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that. But what I would say is, if the other part of what you're talking about is that you're using the pleasure as an escape, I think that part of this is to learn the balance to enjoy, pleasures for what they are and not for what they're not. Like anybody who's dieting, forget about somebody with a food addiction, which is a whole other piece. But I'm saying, even somebody who's dieting knows, right, that if you try to starve yourself, when you finally eat, it's much, much harder to eat in moderation, right? So the common wisdom of dieting, right, is set up a food plan, right, and eat even when you're not hungry, what were you supposed to eat? So, because then the food is not anything bigger than it was supposed to be. Now, our emotions need to be fed, too. We have dire for aesthetic experiences, for pleasures, for love. The trick might be is to think about engaging in different things, not because you're starving, but because it's just something that would be appropriate and reasonable at this particular time in your life, and that may take life experience to learn. And addicts are oftentimes short on life experience because we spend so much time not living life in a certain way, right? So, trial and error is maybe a part of this, but the point is that just like one, if you want to have a healthy diet, you eat reasonably, and even maybe when you're not hungry, because you're trying to make food into what it is and not what it isn't. Other pleasures might be approached that way too. I wish I could talk more. I really have to keep this other commitment.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. That's awesome.
Thank you. All name. Thank you. You too. Thank you, everybody. David Chaim, I think you might not be there. Anyways, Amazon Gesundheit, I really appreciated the call. It was quite the difference. It was very different than a regular, typical call. But it was very nice. Okay. I wish everybody a good day. This is Noble signing off. Hello? Who's that? Is that David Chaim?
No. Yes, I just hopped back on.
Oh.
My phone call dropped. Yes. Rabbi, are you still on, Rabbi Foreman?
I think he left. But he did give a tshuva on my question. That was very interesting. But that was a very atypical...
Right.
To me, call from
the one we have. Hold on, excuse me just a second. Let me please end the recording, okay?